Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, January 12th. I'm Ray Graff. Well, it's that time once again. It's time to convene the Science Forum on Vox Pop, and we welcome back three brilliant scientific persons to the program. The lines are now open. If you have a scientific inquiry of any kind, try to stump the panel. It's always fun. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Always best to get in early on these programs so you're not left out at the end, right? 800-348-2551. Or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Who knows where this program will take us? Every show, always a little different on the Science Forum. We'll kick it off after the news. Well, hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum. Always an exciting day, always making radio history here in Studio A. We bring back our panel of scientists to answer your questions. The number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You may also email the program if you wish. Try to keep the emails relatively concise. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the phone number, and it is a call-in show after all, 800-348-2551. Yes, it's the Science Forum. So why don't we have our scientists sign in, please?
This is Barbara Brabant.
Oh, my God. We'll turn your mic on first, and then we'll sign in, please.
It sure looks like it's on.
Now you're on.
Okay, great. This is Barbara Brabant from SUNY Cobleskill. I'm a biochemist.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist.
I'm Ed Stander, and I'm not a chemist.
You see, by the way, I just wanted to mention that this is not our engineer's fault. What happens is we have a lot of microphones, and the arms are moved in crazy ways. And so he had that microphone where you were sitting, Barbara, turned on. Unfortunately, you're not on that microphone.
Oh, my gosh.
Not
it's
your
like
fault.
Jenga.
And not Zach, the engineer's fault. Let it
I
be known.
That.
Let it be written. So it shall be done.
Zach, I applaud you.
Well done, Zach. And this is the first time that it really wasn't your fault. So congratulations on that.
I've got two microphones now on you me have... now so that I can be heard in stereo.
Terrific. You know, it doesn't really work that way, right?
No.
Please don't do music again.
You know. Jim, I understand you brought some interesting information to the table today.
Yes, this is actually it's a couple months old, but kind of surfaced.
Well, it's fresh for us, certainly.
Surfaced
public radio, after all.
On my pile of magazines. And it's actually some good environmental news.
Oh, good.
It's quoting a study published in the Geophysical Research Letters, on which analytical chemists were analyzing lead levels in peat bogs in northern Alberta.
Uh-huh.
And they have found that the environmental concentration of lead has sunk back down to what it was in pre-industrial and actually even prehistoric days.
Wow.
Since people have been polluting the environment with lead since the Bronze Age.
So that's great.
It's great.
It's great for people who live in peat bogs in Alberta.
Well, I mean, you look at a peat bog, but really what you're looking at is global deposits. I mean, I know Ed knows this, but by looking at a place that's not influenced locally by anthropogenic changes, you're really looking at the whole system. It's kind of like why people do research on Antarctica. It's not that Antarctica is awesome, which it is, but rather it's a place where we can minimize the nominal effects of people and look to see how our planet responds otherwise.
Hmm. Have you been to Antarctica?
No, but it's on my bucket list, and everybody who knows me knows I want to go.
It's cold.
I don't mind cold.
Yeah?
I'm cold most of my life, so I might as well be cold for a reason.
I was up in the Arctic for 3 years, and while I was up there, I think I mentioned this before on the show, there was a woman who wandered around and determined what the concentrations of lead and such were in people by taking urine samples, and she was known as the pee-pee lady.
It was not me.
No, but she would wander around.
There's been entirely too much talk about PP on the radio the last 48 hours. So let's just go to the phones at 800-348-2551. Jim in Albany. Jim, you're on.
Hey, hello, Ray. How are you today?
Good. Nice to have you here.
All right. You too. This is great news about the closing of the Indian Point nuclear power plant. And I'm just wondering, what have they been doing with the nuclear byproducts? And what are they going to do with them in the future? Are they going to leave them around the Hudson River in New York City metropolitan area? Or do they have any plans whatsoever to get rid of these
toxic
materials?
Right? There's a protocol to get rid of the spent fuel rods? No, Jim is shaking his head.
Well, the protocol is to put them into these very heavily armored tanks. They look like large scuba tanks. And then you set them on a bit of a scaffolding, usually in an open air environment, and you let them cool off very slowly. They put off a little bit of thermal energy while they're continuing to decay. And that is the typical protocol. I don't know if that's what's in store for Indian Point, because
don't
I think this is a little...
Don't they go to Yucca Flats or somewhere?
No, we don't do Yucca Flats.
No?
No, that was the original plan. But then people who were on railroad lines really didn't like the idea of large amounts of fuel being transported.
Yeah. So
they stay relatively local.
Yeah, most of the stuff is on the sites where it was created.
And to a good extent, that's necessary because of the cost involved in decommissioning one of these plants, which is more, it costs more than the amount of electricity that it produced during its lifetime. So they've had a problem. One of the reasons that the plants want to stay open is because they have to keep on making money to be able to pay for the decommissioning when it comes.
Very interesting.
There was an excellent show last night on PBS about alternative plant structures and then what to do with the spent fuel rods as a means of creating not high energy but medium energy inputs so that you could take the decaying nuclear material, not really change it at all, but harness the heat that's being given off in small amounts and then turn that into electricity. It was fascinating to watch it from a scientific perspective. And then, of course, there's always the but what if.
You can reconstitute the rods, though, can you not?
They're really just sitting. They're just large cylinders. I mean, they're not terribly large. They're probably as thick as a human arm, but kind of long. And they're just metal. I mean...
And all they're really doing is producing heat anyway, and the heat turns to steam, which turns the turbine, which makes it work. So as long as they produce heat, they can produce some electricity.
Let's go to David and Troy. David, you're on.
Oh, thank you. A question about a fossil I found. It looks a little bit like a scallop shell, except it has a sort of central keel. It's not so much I want to identify it as I found it in a shale pit on a hilltop in Middleburg. So this is, I don't know, 1,600 feet above sea level. And what I'm curious about is, well, it's a shell, a seashell, a aquatic animal. Maybe it was just a mountaintop lake that it lived in, but maybe this hilltop that's 1,600 feet above sea level used to be in the ocean. Maybe the ocean was up there. I don't know. And that's my question.
You got it.
Does this represent an ocean that used to cover the hills in Middleburg?
Yeah.
Or maybe there was just a lake up there that it lived in?
No. First of all, the shell is probably a Japidula cuimanensis. How's that?
It's easy for you to say.
That's right. Japidula cuimanensis, because that's a shell that looks like a scallop shell, which has a septum in the center. And it comes from the Queman's Formation, which is part of what's called the Helderberg Formation, because it's part of the Helderberg Mountains. And it's quite common around here. And what it indicates is that these normally formed in the ocean, relatively shallow water. Lots of water movement around, but relatively shallow water. And it was sea level at the time. And the fact that it was in the shale beds, well, the shale beds are a little bit higher, but it probably got carried there as part of a glacial material. But yeah, the whole area under Middleburg was underwater about 400 million years ago.
There you go.
Yeah. How long ago?
About 350, 400 million years ago. There was an ocean there called Iapetus. And the rocks that formed in that area formed a sort of a shallow bay right around the equator, which is where the rocks were at that time.
Whoa. Right. So if you think of Middleburg as the Caribbean 400 million years ago, that's how much rock really does move.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, David, thanks for that call. That was a good one. 800-348-2551. Kylie in Hudson is on.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I have a question about a new technology called the M-Drive, and I would love a layman's explanation of how in the world they've got propulsion with no matter.
I don't know a great deal about that, but from what I've read, the amount of propulsion, if it's anything, is practically nothing. They had to go to great, great lengths to measure what they measured.
Do we know what? Can you tell me what the M drive is?
Oh, I believe it's sending microwaves down a particularly shaped cavity, and it's supposed to give thrust without throwing any matter in the direction of a I mean, a rocket engine works by shooting matter down the exhaust, and then for every that action, you get the reaction
sure. that
pushes the rocket. The downside is you got to carry something to throw overboard, mm-hmm. essentially. Okay, this is using microwaves in a specially shaped cavity that's supposed to give a net thrust.
Hmm.
Now, there's all sorts of laws of physics that says you can't do that. Now, apparently, some people associated with NASA have detected a little bit of thrust by using something called a torsion balance in a vacuum chamber.
Oh, geez.
And then they were able to detect that there was apparently a little bit of thrust. Maybe, maybe not. There's lots of things that can make little tiny amounts of forces. It's not anything that anybody's going to be making starships out of in any kind of reasonable future. There's doubt about whether that effect exists at all. And if it does, it's extremely minuscule.
And you've got things, for example, like a radiometer, where it's just a ball with little fins inside in a vacuum, and you hit it with light and it spins. It's a child's toy. And the way that operates effectively is by heating the fins inside there by the light and electrons or atoms moving from one side to the other. When you have a torsion balance, even though it's very, very low, or torsion beam, even though it's very, very low friction, it still has material, and material can interact with light to produce a motion. Yeah. So it's hard to say what actually is doing it.
Yeah, a torsion balance is basically a bar that's supported in the middle by a fiber.
A extremely thin fiber.
So it doesn't take much to cause it to twist.
Mm.
And you can even detect the force of gravity out from a big metal sphere with a torsion balance. So it's extremely sensitive. And it required that sort of thing to be able to find any effect. So it's nothing that I'm going to invest in.
But if there was some scientifically vetted experiment that shows there may be something to this, then what could you extrapolate down the road from this? It's a change in physics?
You could get very low energy but cheaper propulsion. So you're not going to go fast and far, but you could kind of putt something.
Well, in space, though... Yeah. You wouldn't need much to, once you get started, you keep going, yeah, right?
Right. What it would be is for example, okay, we're fantasizing now.
Of course.
If you have this kind of drive and a fusion reactor on your spaceship, you could, all you need then is the fuel to make the energy. You don't have to throw mass overboard
right.
to get propulsion. And that would make it much easier, for example, to design something to get to the nearest stars.
It would be 100% efficient.
Let's take a break here. It's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander, the scientists. Ray Graff, your host. We'll be right back.
Comes from Stavros, helping people with disabilities achieve their dreams. Offices in Amherst, Greenfield, and Springfield. Stavros.org for more information. And the Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, hosting an open house for students pre-K through grade 12 on January 21st from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. All campuses open for tours. WaldorfSaratoga.org for details.
Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum with Ray Graff and our scientists today, Barbara Brabets is here, Jim Pickett and Ed Stander, and the email address, by the way, is voxpop@wamc.org. We will take care of a couple of email questions, and then on to the phones once again. This one's from James, who writes, the nuclear waste that's just sitting around, could that be used in an RTG? Or is it only 238 PU that can be used for that? That's uranium-238?
Yes.
Okay. That would probably produce only a small amount of electrical power, but still make some while the waste cools.
Right. And the point is, it's waste energy. It's just being given off to the environment. If anyone is familiar with the Albany landfill, I know you think landfill, you think nuclear waste, not. There's a burn off of methane that has been happening at the Albany landfill for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And only in the last few years have they finally gotten to the point where they've taken this waste product and turned it into a benefit where they can now generate electricity and heat from it. So the same idea, you've got something that's already a waste, you've got it radiating heat to the planet, heat some water to move a turbine to make some electricity.
All right. This one's from Nelson in Delanson. What would be an analogy for human activity in the Earth's atmosphere? Lighting a match in a 9x12 room or a bonfire in a 9x12 room or something similar? That's Nelson.
That's a great question, Nelson. I think it depends on what part of our landscape we're really looking at. If you think of population, I'd think we're a bonfire because our population has exploded from a sheer number standpoint, much more so than a match. And then there's a ripple effect, sorry for the analogy, with the bonfire in the room, because the population then has these bounce backs of waste, food, health, longevity, technology.
Well, yeah, in terms, if you're talking about it in terms of thermal, like the greenhouse effect, that's on the order of a watt per square meter. Mm. So that's more on the level of a small light bulb in the room.
Okay.
And Rob, the sun gives 1,000 watts per square meter. So
yeah.
Let's go to Robert in Middletown. Robert.
At peak, yeah.
Yep.
Hello, Robert.
Hello, sir. I was just wondering, this morning at the roundtable, they were talking about, the fact that we eat a lot of sugar products and stuff like that. And I know from my own experience that if you eat something like candy, it produces an acid and you could lose teeth and all that. I was just wondering how that would relate to our pH in our body. What kind of balance should we have there?
Okay,
pH. That's a great question, and there's a bunch of pieces to it, and I'll try to kind of keep to the simple. So sugars, when you chew them or dissolve them in your saliva, you have enzymes in your saliva that start to break down those sugars almost immediately. There's the old kindergarten science experiment where they give a kid a bolus of white bread, and you have them put up how many fingers of sweetness they taste based on the time that they chew. So when you start chewing the white bread, you don't taste very much, but as the amylase in your saliva starts to break down those starches to sugars, the kid registers more and more sugar.
Uh-huh.
So that those sugars don't necessarily create acid, but what they do is they promote bacterial growth. And the bacteria, when they eat your sugar in your mouth, they poop out, they poop out the acid, and that's what causes the decay. So the decay from your teeth is really a biological, not a chemical effect.
There you go.
Yeah. So, also, I heard something about the fact that if you have, sugar is suspected as causing inflammation in the body, that means it's causing the imbalance in the body system.
Well, let's go back to the biology again. If you are feeding organisms that cause inflammation, like bacteria, right? Think of any kind of pussy wound that you have, may have bacteria in it. If you're feeding them, if you have an unregulated sugar in your blood, for example, or even just in your GI tract, if you feed it too much refined sugar, you can get inflammation. Again, the sugar itself isn't causing the inflammation, but the cascading effect of the sugar causes other organisms to have you inflamed. So there's other things in our lives that cause inflammation. Stress causes inflammation. Yeah. So even if we had a good, what we call microbiome, we had a healthy biology of other organisms living in us, stress in and of itself can change how we react to the sugars in our body and create that. So,
the other part of it is that the acid in your stomach already is extremely high.
Oh, yes.
And
it's
so
not an acid issue.
It's not an acid issue per se, except when it's in your mouth and affecting your teeth. But as far as the acid being produced by the bacteria, it's pretty well nullified by what's happening as you swallow and it goes into your stomach.
Right. But different bacterial populations live in different pockets of your body.
Right.
Let's go to Malcolm in Albany. Malcolm, you're on.
Hey, I have a question about sound waves and how you would describe timbre in music with a sound wave.
Okay, who wants to jump? Ed, you're the guy who plays the glasses. You go
ahead.
Oh,
and Ray, you know you're going to get in this.
No way.
Yeah. Well, we could start with the biology of the system.
There's no bacteria in Cameron.
No inflammation that we need to discuss? All right, fine.
No, but
pussy wounds or anything? Good, good.
Timbre. Basically, it has to do with how the cilia in your cochlea pick up the sound waves and how your mind then analyzes it and produces the feeling of what you're hearing. Depending on the width of the sound waves, the wavelength, you'll have different effects as it gets into your inner ear, and that will then trigger your mind to give you a feeling of what sort of sound it is. But you're not actually hearing it directly, of course. You're hearing it through your biology.
Okay, you did win on that. It is biology.
It is, yes.
But you can record it and still...
No, because then the recording comes out and you pick it up on your biology as to what it is.
Okay.
But timbre, if anything, has to do with the frequency of the sounds and the combination of the frequencies that you're hearing. And that has to do with the way in which your ear perceives it.
There you go. Well, Malcolm, thank you for that one. We are varied on the program today. What next? What fresh hell is this? Richard in Schenectady. Richard, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, all. Somebody was just talking about a population explosion on the planet here, and I've heard from several, I think, reliable sources on the television that we're projected to reach a limit of about 9 billion people by the year 2050, and I think we kind of have to do that in some sense. But it seems to me, the last I knew, when we passed 7 billion, that every time we reach a billion, it takes less and less time. And it seems like the graph would still be like a parabola heading upward. How are we possibly going to be able to level off in 33 years to a plateau?
I think that is the question that population scientists talk about all the time. If you go back 50 or 60 years when we were approaching 1 billion, and the scientists were projecting that the planet could not sustain 1 billion people. It did. I don't think it did it well, but it did. So we got there. So there's the if you think of the curve looks kind of not parabolic. It looks more like a hockey puck or a hockey stick, rather, kind of flat.
Okay.
And then it kind of curves up at the end really, really fast. So it's even more dramatic than a parabola. The 9 billion number I've heard bandied about as well, you get to resources, right? So you get to stratification, the haves and the have-nots, who has access to materials, who doesn't, access to clean water. I think water is a far bigger issue than petroleum ever will be, because you can live without petroleum, not well, but you can. You can't live without water. And that's one of the reasons why I teach water chemistry. Starting next week.
Oh, boy. And when do classes start?
The 23rd.
Okay. I wanted to get that
thanks,
out there.
Thanks, Ray.
Yeah.
but, you know, from a population dynamics perspective, we seem to have always gotten it together, even with the populations that we've had. But I don't think we do it well. And if we look back at other mass extinctions, not necessarily Homo sapiens, but others, there's been some cataclysmic event which causes a mass extinction.
But isn't it ultimately a self-regulating system? In other words, if you were to put 500 rats in a box, eventually there will be less rats.
Sure, you just don't want it to be your kid.
No, but what I'm saying is ultimately...
Yeah, well, the number that's bandied around at that point is 31 billion.
31 billion.
We can sustain 31 billion on the face of the earth, but nobody would be happy. We can take all 7 billion people, stick them in Texas, give them 3/4 of an acre of land.
You're kidding me.
And we'd still have room. So it's a question.
Why don't we
do
that then?
Well,
that's free will.
That's a great thing.
That's,
yeah.
You know, free will's. It's a hard one to try to take away free will. We're not really good at that.
Well, why should we? Are scientists ultimately dictators?
Well,
I mean, what about free will?
One of the biggest problems we have are political boundaries and the fact that people are not able to move around where they could.
So you want one world government?
Well,
so now we have a dictator over here government over here.
Well, now you're putting words in my microphone.
Use the other one.
I don't think that science is really looking at that. I think there are other pieces that we can do that will push the hockey stick further down the graph until we can get our act together.
Right. We can, for example, have two-child families. We can require two-child families.
As China does. Oh, hi, Dennis. Just hang on. We're just wrapping up here. I hit the button. I thought we were done.
We are done?
Okay.
All right, Dennis and Gilderland, now it's your turn. You've interrupted, so go right ahead.
I don't mind being interrupted. Right, scientists, thanks for being here. Question is, when did the four seasons first emerge? I'm assuming that there was an ice age once hard, and that seasons from that developed. When did the four seasons first emerge?
The four seasons first emerge?
Well, Frank, New Jersey, right? Frankie Valley.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, there have always been seasonal effects because the Earth's axis has presumed been tilted for a very, very long time. It's a matter of how that plays out where in a particular location. I mean, for example, right now, near the equator, there's not a lot of seasonal difference in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Earth is all or most of the Earth is tropical, let's say in one of the periods millions of years ago, then seasonal variations won't make much difference.
Uh-huh.
Similarly, when there
can I interrupt a sentence? Sure. But I'm assuming during the Ice Age, it was just one season.
Yeah. So during a time at
a certain point, there must have been some diversity, whether it were two seasons and then three, then four. At what point in our geological history did we get that variation?
Because of the Earth's tilt, though, there must have been variations even in the Ice Age.
In fact, weren't they worse?
You're mixing two things there. You're mixing climate effects and seasonal effects. There was a period of time when the glaciers took over, effectively, and during that time, places like Utah, which right now are very hot, were much cooler.
Mm-hmm.
So there are climatic effects which can occur over time because the sun cools down or the sun warms up. But the basic idea of the seasons is simply caused by the fact that the Earth is tilted where you're sitting is either tilted towards the sun or it's tilted away. Uh-huh. And as a result, the amount of light hitting your area is either greater or less, if you will. So there have always been seasons, but there have been on top of that larger global changes occurring just simply because of our position in the universe or because of changes in the atmosphere.
Or transport of energy around the planet.
Right.
And over to Philip in Amsterdam. Philip, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
In Fukushima, I think the same situation occurred where they had the waste canisters up on a rack above the reactors.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then they say they're doing that at any point. Isn't it totally perilous? You know, you're talking about, you know, how you saw this situation where the reactor has to be shrouded in concrete so that a plane crashing into it would not affect it. But, you know, a plane, you know, it just hit the racks and the stuff out there in the field. How is it protected?
Okay.
Well, it's protected in the sense that given its static situation. So if I had a tank of gas sitting in my yard in a nice armored propane tank, I could still have a plane hit me. I could still have, you know, my husband hit the wrong pedal and he could run into the tank and he could blow it up. Yeah, let's hope he doesn't. But the chances of something of that happening are very small. Okay? So in the static situation, it's enormously safe. But for that infinitesimal small chance that something could go wrong, it's a cataclysmic event, right? Because then you're spreading around highly radioactive material and into the air, which will transport it from one location to another.
Right.
So it's small probability, but high impact. And so it's the balance of that small probability, but high impact if something does happen, the oh shoot moment, that you want to balance when you're talking about storage of waste.
Yeah, and you have to remember that Fukushima is built in a place that gets 2,000 to 3,000 earthquakes a year.
Yeah.
While a place like on the east coast of the United States, the chances of having a cataclysmic earthquake, such as what happened to Fukushima, is pretty well nil.
And the waste that they were storing on the racks, that was actually inside their containment, that was stuff that they had just pulled out as part of a refuel. We're not talking about the lower-level nuclear waste that they store outside.
Go over to Reed and Troy. Reed.
Yes, I want to ask about air that goes through an internal combustion engine. And I would assume probably the ratio of gas to air has been established. But what I would like to see as a possible way to convince people of what's going on in their engines is that what if a car drives 10 miles at 30 miles an hour, and what would the column of air on the footprint of that car look like? How high would that be?
Are you meaning it's exhaust? Are you meaning the input of oxygen or the output of CO2?
The air that literally had to go through that engine and out the back, how tall would that column of air be on the footprint of that car?
Okay.
Well, to calculate that, you'd have to take the volume of the cylinder.
Which is usually given as 2 or 3 liter.
Yeah, and then multiply that by the number of, the 2 or 3 cycle. Liters total number of cylinders.
And then
by the RPMs. RPMs.
Mm-hmm.
And the RPMs, yes.
And the time.
That's it.
Well, let me back up. I read in a motorcycle magazine once that at idle, in 5 minutes' time, a car breathes something like 3 times its volume. And that really astounded me. And when I thought, oh, my God, look at all the cars out there. Mm-hmm. How much air are they literally breathing in and putting out the back?
Right.
And I would just like to see kind of like a poster. Oh, you don't believe in global warming. Here's what your car just did. Here's how much air.
Well, it's not so much a matter of the amount of air going in. It's the amount of carbon dioxide coming out.
Right.
And essentially, half of the weight of the fuel that you burn ends up as carbon dioxide.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. So think about the time that you're at the pump every week and how much you're pumping in, how many gallons you're pumping in that period of time. Half of that comes out the other end as CO2.
Yeah. Well,
pumping it out.
Well, actually, thinking of the carbon in the fuel.
Right.
I mean, it's almost all because there's a...
Yep.
There's the amount of hydrogen is only about 10 or 20%.
Yep. We need to take a quick break here. Our number on Vox Pop, the science forum, is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander, the panel today, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. edith-hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. And the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. skidmore.edu/tang.
Vox Pop on WAMC, where the conversation never ends, even during the breaks. It's 800-348-2551, the science forum. You get a few scientists in a room, and boy, the conversation, it just keeps going.
It's getting hot in here, actually.
It really is. It really is. This is an email that came in from David. And getting back to the M drive we discussed early in the program, and David writes, doesn't this rocket violate conservation of linear momentum? To propel the rocket in outer space where there's no atmosphere, the rocket must eject mass. And that's from David. Anybody?
Yes, that's one of the problems with that.
We're all scratching our head over that.
There's laws of physics.
Well played, David. Two marks for you. This one is from Brendan, who's from Earth, who says, here in the Northeast, why is it that the coldest time of year does not align with the shortest days of the year?
That's a great question. There's that lag because it's not just about the heating and cooling of the air, which heats up really quickly and cools down really quickly, but there's also the heating and cooling of the earth, which is a lag. So just like if you think of a hot day at the beach on Lake George in May, the sand is really, really hot, the air is really, really hot, and the water is freezing cold still because it takes a while for that latent heat to be captured.
And also, we have a lot of heat coming from the south and a lot of cold coming from the north, and depending on where they meet, you get different temperatures.
Now, this is from, I don't know if you can handle this one, we'll try. This is from Mark. Could you please explain what fainting is? What is happening to the body when a person faints? Why do some people seem to faint while others don't? Is fainting bad, and is it a sign of bad health? That's from Mark.
Well, I am not a medical doctor.
Okay.
So Dr. Shartok will be happy to hear
well,
me
he's
say
a medical
that.
Doctor as well?
No.
Okay, because I didn't
but
think
he hangs
so.
Out with
he's a soft scientist.
Yeah, well, I won't. No.
No.
He's a hard scientist.
Really?
I don't
he's
know.
A hard scientist doing the soft sciences.
Okay, you said that right, not
yeah,
me.
Yeah, exactly.
Fainting usually comes about because it's a change in blood pressure between
your brain
and the rest of your body. And so if your brain sees a fluctuation in blood pressure, it says, you know what, it's probably best that you be on the ground right now. Mm. Because if you're on the ground, your brain's going to be on the ground. Your brain is the largest requirement for calories and air and all that other stuff. And so if you're prone, even if you have a bump on your head, at least the brain is going to get the blood.
Oh.
So your blood pressure will come back up. These are called episodes of syncope. That's the phrase. And it doesn't necessarily need to be that there's a real blood pressure change. It could be that one of your blood pressure sensing systems in your body is a little off kilter.
Well, there you go.
So if you think of your little gyros not working correctly, then even if your blood pressure is fine, but your gyros are off, you're going to faint. So
what
some
about
people
when
do.
You faint at the sight of blood. I knew a person who fainted at the sight of blood, even on videos.
That's a feedback mechanism to those gyros that we talked about the blood pressure. So instead of the being only sensors, they're inputting into the system and making your blood pressure drop.
Oh.
So it's like a reverse of the method that it's supposed to work.
Very interesting. James in New Windsor is on. James, you're on.
Yes. I heard on the show a few months ago that if you made pure water, pure H2O, it would not be good for consumption. Is that correct or not?
That's true. If you drank just distilled water, you would put your body through some serious stress. Yes.
Why is that?
And it tastes bad, too.
Oh, yeah. Your body doesn't like it, actually. Because you actually are about 0.9% salt, and you need that 0.9% salt. If you give yourself 0% salt, what will happen is it'll deplete the salt from all your normal tissues, and your kidneys will have to fight that.
And what if you were in a situation where you only had bottles of distilled water and salt? Could you put the salt in the distilled water, mix it up, and take a swill?
That's why you should take chemistry so that you can save yourself when you're at the ocean, and you had bottles of distilled water, and you got seawater, and you can...
If I had taken chemistry, I might not have ended up in radio. It might have worked out really well for me.
I am still here in radio.
Hey, James, thanks a lot.
I thought you were an old salt.
Hey, that's very... Okay, the show's almost over. Robin in Albany. Robin, you're on.
Hi, thank you. Sort of a speculative question. I've been always interested in space travel, but if you take a moment, back away from your sci-fi and respect the speed of light as a hard limit, then all you are left with is very, very slow space travel. And that brings us to the other sci-fi trope of suspended animation. So I was curious, with all these biochemists, what you had to say about how realistic or what would be the things that would have to happen to get us to the point where you could actually, you know, put somebody in their cold sleep and let them sit there for a couple hundred years.
I love it.
Well,
there's a lot of science behind this, actually, and a lot of it comes out of the science of aging, because aging is an irreversible process that we see, as much as the commercials on television don't want you to think that. And probably the number one factor beyond genetics that influences the rate of aging is calorie consumption. So if you can severely restrict calorie consumption, you can slow the progress of time for that organism. So we've had worms. I know you're all worried about the age of worms and the lifespan of worms, but we've had worms live 50 times their normal lifespan by restricting the calorie consumption of these worms. Now, they're pathetic worms who are awfully hungry. I feel for the poor guys.
Nice.
But they live 50 times beyond their natural life expectancy. We've done this with worms. We've done this with small mammals like mice and rats. We've done it with insects. And there are some populations of indigenous peoples that are already calorie restricted where they're doing it on their own. And then we've looked to their longevity maps and seen that the effects on their genome, because you can not only tell someone's age by, you know, counting the rings on their tree, but you can also look at how much genetic damage has been done to their DNA over their lifespan.
Yeah.
And that kind of gives you a rate of aging. And so we can look at these indigenous populations that have calorie-restricted diets and see that they, too, are not aging as fast as the rest of us.
Well, that's great.
And then longevity rather than suspended animation.
Well, it's the first step.
But that gets you to where you need to be,
but we
right?
We have, for example, frogs that can go into suspended animation.
Sure.
They can actually be frozen solid, and they can be brought back.
Right.
And there are people, for example, who have been under the ice for long periods of time, for hours at times, and they can come out and wind up being correct.
You know, I think if you thawed out Ted Williams' head, he'd still hit 350. Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah, and just think he could have knee replacement surgery and all that other stuff, you know, build the new body.
I was trying to be serious here.
Oh.
Right. Walt Disney, too. He's in there.
Is Walt Disney frozen?
Yeah, Ted Williams and Walt Disney are right next to each other. Are they? Their heads are right next to
neighbors.
Each other.
They're neighbors. Oh, yes. I'll be darned. Now, why not the whole body?
They figure if you've got the head, you've got the genes, and then you can build everything else from there. But that personality is inherent in the brain. That was the story.
It takes less space.
And yeah, you can actually still have your whole body frozen at death, or you can just go for the head, and the head is cheaper. It's something like, last time I looked, it was like $300,000 for the head. It was like $750,000 for the whole body. Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. So $350,000 to freeze your head.
Yeah.
I'd do it for less.
And then they promise that if the power goes out, they'll keep you frozen.
How are they going to do that?
How do they promise? You're dead. How do they promise you?
That's right. All right. Well, this is very...
$350,000? I'm sorry. Our question went a little... but it's interesting. The whole idea of suspended animation, I think, really is in some way tied to our aging process.
Let's go to Bruce in Jefferson, New York. Bruce, you're on the Science Forum. Hello, Bruce. Oh, Bruce, you waited like 20 minutes, man. Are you there? Oh, boy. Are you there, Bruce?
Yes, I have a couple. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a couple different questions.
All right.
Probably the speed of sound at sea level. Can you tell me what it is in miles per hour and kilomiles per hour at sea level, and also what it is at 1,600 feet in Jefferson here? I believe there's a difference.
Well, it's 330 meters per second. What that would be for miles per hour, I'm not really quite sure.
It's about 800 and something. But it changes with relative humidity. The speed of sound changes not just with elevation, but it changes with the components that are dissolved in the atmosphere.
So is it the density of
dense the atmosphere is, how much water vapor is there. So on a cold day in Jefferson versus a warm day in Jefferson, you get a different speed of sound.
Huh. Why do you ask, Bruce?
Various reasons. I showed somewhere I found 767 miles per hour or 1,234 kilometers per hour. I was looking, and other places I find really different. So is there at sea level, irregardless of the atmospheric conditions?
You can't do it regardless of the atmospheric conditions.
It's done dry at 68 degrees Fahrenheit.
The dry weight is what they talk about.
All right.
There's charts on the internet that you can pull up that have them depending on the relative humidity.
Okay. And then you had another question, Bruce?
Yeah, I have a 1943 Mercury Daimler that's irradiated, and it's in this display case. And I've had it for years, and I was wondering how to have that tested. Barbara, are you up in Colville School College?
I am.
Okay, because I'm right down the road from you. I go past you just about every day. Is there any way I can meet with you on different items? I also have a rock that I suspect is a meteorite. I've been dealing with a professor up in Cornell,
and sent him emails on that. He's not sure what it is.
Well,
so I was wondering.
You want to email the program, and then we can get in touch with Barbara?
Why don't you email the program?
So it'll be voxpop@wamc.org, and then we'll make sure Barbara gets it. Now, how the heck do you suspect that the dime has been irradiated?
Because it's in a round display case. It's about an inch and a half around, and it's in glass, and it says this has been irradiated at someplace.
Oh, okay. So was that a nuclear test or something?
Yeah, evidently, or something that, you know, when they were developing the H-bomb, they decided, hey, let's sell these things. We can make a fortune.
Very interesting. You know,
and it's something I haven't carried around in my top pocket.
Well, actually, if you want to have the dime checked, what I would do is talk to John Garver down at Union College, who looks at the effects of irradiation on glass.
Oh, there you go.
And he would actually be able to tell whether the dime was irradiated
John
by
Garver?
What's going on with the glass. Yes.
Yep, jgarver@union.edu.
All right, Bruce. Hey, thanks a lot. That was terrific. 800-348-2551. Let's go over to Bonnie. Oh, I knocked Bonnie off the air. Bonnie, are you still there?
Hello.
Hello, Bonnie, you're on.
Yes, hi. I got to tell you, you're fading in and out a lot.
Really?
You're loud, the callers are loud, and everybody else is like whispers.
Well, can I tell you why, Bonnie, really quickly? When your phone feed is not being processed with a compressor limiter that we get over the airwaves, so when you're hearing us on the phone, some of these scientists, they'll drift back from the microphone. They'll be far away. They mumble.
We use our hands.
Exactly. Ugh. So anyway, they'll speak very closely to the microphone. What is your question?
Thank you. Okay, this is dystopic, and it's probably January blues working here.
Okay.
This has to do with us as an invasive species, but it has more to do with what's going to take us out. Are we going out with a bang or a whimper? And everybody in the room should have their own views. And each one should give A, B, and C probability.
Oh, boy.
We don't have time for that. But,
this is 6 minutes.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a whimper and stepwise whimpers. Whimper one, whimper two, whimper three. I have no basis for this because you're asking us to speculate. Scientists
exactly.
are not good at speculating, but that's
know,
what
but
you've
try.
Asked us
it's
for,
fun.
Right?
So it's a whimper. It's a whimper for Barbara.
Yeah, and a disease is be at least two out of three of the whimpers if we're picking.
Jim, what do you think?
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Yeah?
You're for whimpers?
Okay,
yeah,
and how about Ed?
Well, with an exponential curve, we go up, we double our population every 30 years, so my guess is going to be a rather quick bang.
You're all wrong. It's an asteroid. Asteroid.
Well, then
coming.
We just won't
yes.
know.
And Bonnie, what do you think, real quickly?
Oh, I think we'll kind of do it to ourselves. I think it's going to be a combination of overpopulation is going to drive some disease that'll get out of hand and will, before it moderates and, you know, genetically over time, it'll take out more of us than can survive afterwards.
Well, what a happy call. And
oh,
thank
yeah.
you. Thank you, Bonnie.
Happy New Year, Bonnie.
Appreciate that. Oh, God, the show's almost over. Malcolm and Amherst. Malcolm, you're on.
Hi there. I know there's a short time,
yes.
Just some quick notes. In terms of the M drive, I think that the goal there was to treat it more like a solar sail so that over a time, that little bits of momentum really will add up.
Okay.
On the timbre thing, I know that you're approaching it through biology, but that's how we hear it. In terms of how those sounds are made and how they sound differently, which is really where the timbre differences come from, that's not where we're hearing it. That's how they're being produced. That's in the instrument bodies and the various membranes and all the things that are vibrating differently, and they're different sound spectrum.
Right.
But my original thing was lately what's going on is somebody figured out that basically there was a miscalculation that made people think that the galaxy disks spinning wasn't right, and that's why, you know, there was dark matter. And so someone figured out, oh, no, wait, there's really more matter there than we thought. And so now it all crunches out, but I'm still hearing tons of stuff about, you know, here's how, you know, it's still the mystery of dark matter, the mystery of dark matter. I wonder what your take is on, you know, we're living in a new age. I realize people have produced big specials and everything, but once you find out, it's kind of dead. It's dead. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not officially dead,
okay.
But although it never really lived because we didn't know what it was,
no,
right?
Here's the story. Some people started looking at galaxies, not just with visible light, but started looking at them with infrared. And they discovered that based on infrared, they could find that there was a halo effectively around the galaxy. And so what they're seeing is something which could explain why the galaxies are moving the way they are. It doesn't explain what is producing it because we have no idea what is producing it. So the idea of dark matter still exists because we don't know what it is. But now we're getting to the point where we're getting some idea of where it is and how it's distributed.
Oh, I thought this is a different thing. This was about when they were making their original calculations of how much matter really is in the average amount of space that we think of as, you know, within, you know, the matter, I guess the dust and everything within galaxies was underestimated at the time. And now that they know that there's really essentially more matter there, as it was my understanding, they know that that's why it behaves more like something that would be. Yeah, there's more matter there. It's behaving more like a big disk of sandy stuff than this sparse thing than they thought. So it kind of just answers the question.
No, there's really two models. One possibility that still exists. One possibility is the dark matter. The other one is the possibility that the galaxies, because of their size, are moving at a using different physical laws, if you will. And the idea there is that in normal world, force equals mass times acceleration. And in the case of these galaxies, force might equal mass times acceleration to some other number like squared.
Well, I'm afraid that's where we will have to leave the program. Barbara Brabich, classes begin again.
Monday, January 23rd.
At Coble School.
At Coble School.
Oh, that's very exciting stuff.
Yes.
Good luck.
Next time
I see you, you'll be very harried and tired. And
oh, yes.
You look so relaxed now.
Thanks. It's called vacation.
Take a mental picture of that. Jim Pickett, thank you for being here.
Yep. Pleasure.
Ed Stander, you didn't bring the glasses this time. But
I got my glasses. I can't see without them.
Next time. Support comes from Mango Tree Imports, a global fair trade shop in downtown Saratoga Springs in New York, featuring artisan goods from more than 60 countries. MangoTreeImports.com at Facebook. And the Lathrop Communities, serving older adults in the Quaker tradition for over 25 years. Independent living in Northampton and East Hampton, Massachusetts, in the heart of the Pioneer Valley. Lathrop.Kendall.org. Thanks again to our scientific brains for being here today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, the brain at the controls. Colleen O'Connell took your calls very smartly and bigly. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, good heavens, it's a Food Friday, and the folks from Chester's Smokehouse will be here. Oh, my cholesterol's going up already. Stand by for news.